Folks, welcome back to the iHealth channel, iHealth Radio, with your host, Hurricane H, New Day, awesome topic, with an awesome guest. And again, well, my guests are awesome, but you know, today we're talking in the world and realm of mental health, family therapy, addiction, with one of the best in the business. I have with me Andrew Levender. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist, master's addictions counselor. He's a very renowned mental health advocate over 25 years, helped thousands of people, different walks of life, celebrities, athletes, politicians, touches on mental health, resilience, holistic approaches to healing, addiction, recovery, parenting. I mean, I can name a lot of stuff. He's an author. He's been featured on some of the greatest shows, including Oprah. So we're in it for the treat here. So we have a lot to learn today in this particular show about different things in mental health and stuff. He's pretty much active in the, I think, Encino in California, and they have a nice facility where they do have different services that they offer. We're going to talk about all that stuff as well, and all the work that they do, and the type of, you know, healing and therapies and all the stuff, because there's quite a bit out there. But as always, we'll start with a little bit of background on Andrew. Andrew, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, listen, as I said, it is an honor and privilege to have you. I mean, come in and share in your world of wisdom and knowledge here and stuff, you know, with our audiences, because you do have quite a bit of expertise to share. And mental health is a big piece of our health and wellness overall. It doesn't matter where we are in the world, what age group we're in. This is something that's real. We all suffer somehow on the health side, on the mental health specifically. And I think there's so much stuff going on in this world that is impacting how we do, from family, you know, relationship to parenting with our kids or our kids with our parents, and so on and so forth, with the world, you know, events that we have. It's a lot of crazy stuff going on, and it all impacts how we behave, how we deal with things, how we cope with things. So just you know, I know I gave a brief introduction that is not, you know, gonna cover who you are. If you don't mind, Andrew, taking us back a little bit to your work and the different things that you've done and how you got into it in the first place, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. I think that's a great place to start. Is how I found myself in this mental health space. I guess that not the easiest or maybe the hardest story, but I won't. I'll try to make it interesting. Is I was tricked into going to see a therapist first time when I was almost 15 years old. I was really struggling. I was addicted to opiates, pills, an anxious, unhappy, kind of lonely child, and my mother said, how about we go shopping after dinner? And so I said yes. And we ended up in the parking lot of a therapist. And after I was done, how dare you, getting upset about it. For some reason, I went inside, and that changed my life. And I remember thinking to myself, there has to be a catch here. This guy's only job is to try to be helpful to people. That's all, like, because in my head I was like, what's the catch? There must be something that I'm missing. Something I was looking for, a kind of a loophole in there. And I kept going week after week, and I remember honestly thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it out of childhood, but if I do, I'm going to look into being a therapist. And I made it. I'm pausing because I didn't honestly think I would, and now I'm 55, and I'm very grateful to that first therapist. So shout out to Rick Tivers. I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago, and that was a life-changing experience for about a year.
Well, you know, just I want to just pause in there, because this is big, because you talked about your youth and how, I mean, the biggest, I guess, takeaway is that only therapy changed your life, but also saved your life in a way, because you had, it sounds like you had the ideology of, you're not going to make it, maybe suicidal, or maybe, like, you know, this life is not for you, whatever, you want to end it. At least that's what I'm getting from what you throw in there. But the idea is that you were early on in your days. And I think that is a big deal because we have a huge pandemic, I would call it, for our youth with the anxiety and all the, I guess, the depression that they're going through and they've been going through. And we do know that there is high incidence of suicidal, in the age groups that are much younger, in the teen ages and stuff like that. So
Yeah.
it is a very difficult place. Now, you're talking about years back, but back then it was not as bad as it is today, but I think, it just got worse. Now, and by the way, again, congrats to you
Thank
for
you.
making that leap, to the world, and we thank your therapist there for making that change and helping you get to be who you are today, because you are also in exchange helping a lot of other people and thousands of people over, almost a quarter of century. So, if not more, it is an impressive, just a story, just as you just stated. And this is just the first, little bullet really in the discussion, but it is a big one. So let's take us on, I mean, I don't know how much you want to go deep dive in what drove your anxiety at the time, but maybe you could relate that to some of the cases that you see today and what can be done to prevent, because I mean, parenting can be difficult. I'm a parent. I have, a couple of kids that are just going on 18 and 19. I have one that is 27. So I've been through a lot of different, phases of their age, but it is difficult for the parents. It is difficult for them. The environment that we live in is very, how can I say, there's so much pressure in every aspect of it, whether it's the, your friends, the economy sometimes can have a piece of it, the school system can have a piece of it, the news can be war, a piece of it. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world. So in your expertise, how does that all, work, and how we can potentially prevent some of this stuff from happening and not get to the point where people are suicidal?
That's such a it's a giant question, but it, so I'll try to
Sorry about
relate
that.
no I'll try to relate my experience, which I used to think I must be the only person in the world who had the experience that I did, and it turns out that I keep company with roughly 24 to 28 million other men. I was sexually abused between the ages of 6 and 9. And on the one hand, there's the national statistic, which is 1 in 6 boys and 1 in 4 girls before the age of 18 will experience an unwanted sexual experience. And that kind of runs the spectrum of from inappropriate talking to touching. And in the work that I do now, and have for quite some time, the connection between surviving childhood trauma and developing a substance use disorder is incredible. I can't back this up, but it has felt for a long time that they're so closely related, they're like cousins. One oftentimes will come with the other. Because at least for me, between the ages of 6 and 9, I didn't have the language to talk about it. I was told not to talk about it, and so early on, that's where fear, misunderstanding, and confusion comes. The kind of the normal amount of time a secret like this is kept, at least with boys, is 12 years. So that kind of works out. First time I talked about it, I was 19, and at our treatment center, the Encino Detox, in the last almost 2 years, we have treated of all the men in particular, 66%, a little bit more than 66% admit with kind of comorbidity or issues of substance abuse, and underneath it. Is a sexual trauma. And I wasn't surprised. And because I'm able to, I did so much work around this issue, and because I'm able to talk about it, and I'm hesitating because I said, because I can talk about it, and because a lot of people don't talk about it, I found that all I needed was somebody willing to listen and not talk. So that was a savior for me. the secret for so long, and the year after year of the compounding shame and secretiveness, and my own development, it started just to become a heavier problem, and it was manifesting itself in different ways. I know, lots of us know, that in the absence of talking it out, we're going to act it out. And I'd like to say that's true for everybody, but I don't know. But that's my suspicion. Our stuff just leaks out somehow. And so every time we have a new admit at the treatment center, my first goal is to see the person underneath the unwanted behavior. Recently, a wife said, very upset, naturally, and tearful, and do you think you can help my husband? We've tried this 4 times. And I said, respectfully, I said, I'm not sure because I don't know what's wrong. And she was taken by that statement. She said, what's wrong? What do you mean, what's wrong? He can't or won't stop drinking, and our entire family has fallen apart. And it seems like he, loves the bottle more than us. And we've heard these types of stories. And I kind of, in a as neatly as possible, wanted to let her know that I appreciated her so much for the love for her husband. We're going to do our very best, and I'm going to go searching for what's really wrong. And I don't know yet what his story is, but I do think that one of the reasons that I've been successful and the treatment center is successful is because we don't sit around and talk about drinking. I'm just trying to help reintroduce people to themselves in a more loving way. That's really the biggest and the only goal. If that means that person stops drinking and using, that's awesome. But if I can just have a little bit, put a thumbprint on how that person leaves and speaks to themselves, that's really what I'm lo looking to do.
Well, thank you for sharing a little bit. I mean, there's a lot there, especially on a personal note, and you touch on this particular topic of abuse, and you're right, it is a very common, and now more than ever, people are more willing to talk about it, and there's more open discussions. But as you said, a couple of decades back, this was like, you cannot, it's a shame thing, oh my God, the people, how are they going to perceive this whole thing? People believe it, they don't believe it. There's all kind of stuff that, we've heard about, which in turn makes people very reluctant to even mention it. And as you said, you hold on to that thought in your mind and that feeling, and you kind of act on it, meaning you just find another way to kind of just suppress it, and then you do, and people do that. And actually had a couple of discussions about this similar topic, where people actually, I've had a case, someone that held it for years, not decades, not even 12 years or so. It's like, literally at a more adult age, and because they couldn't talk to anyone and had this normal life, yet they still had that whole cloud behind somewhere. And that's the thing, it's like baggage that's in there, it's always going to play on you, and it's very difficult. I mean, I don't know how you did it in the 12 years, but I'm sure it was tough. And then you're
Well,
right, that
I became a drug addict.
there you go. Well, again, you did say that they're very related, but you're right. People, they use, I mean, drug is one, I mean, alcohol is another. There's other types of addiction that people can get really easily into, because they just want to forget that stuff. They don't want to think. You want to just absorb, that thought from your mind and kind of dump it into a locker somewhere in the back, in the subconscious, keep it there. But it's not, you can't run away from it. It's always there. And there's always triggers to these things. And so you just want to numb it. And again, what people, didn't realize, and they still don't realize, a lot of people wind up in as opioids as big, right? And I know you treat on a lot of different types of addictions in your center, and so there's quite a bit of formulas where people, and as a matter of fact, I was talking to someone yesterday or today, literally, and they just, I mean, it's a story on its own. A person almost died of alcohol and drugs, and they were in a coma for days, and life was completely off for them, and then they came back, and now they're doing a lot of work to advocate and do stuff. But it is, this is real, folks. If you're watching, and that's the other thing, it, and people may think like, it doesn't affect me, it's not going to affect me, You may not affect you, may affect someone you know. There's always someone in our circles or someone that we know that knows someone that knows this or has experienced it. So we can't even deny, even our own families, we have that. I've had, drug addiction in my own, family and alcohol in my own family and close by cousins and so on. So I can relate to it. And younger folks, when we were young, and these are, my cousins who have, I lost one of them to drug and alcohol. So I can relate to it personally. And this is real. Now, the child abuse piece or children abuse, that's, as you said, it's very common and we've heard about it. I don't know why it happens, but I guess people are people. There's evil thoughts that may be, always out there, and people don't realize what it takes and what it does to other people when you take on some of these behaviors. These people, I mean, I have to say that sometimes I feel bad for the same these people that even, afflict these things, because they need help themselves. Because you cannot possibly do these things. And again, I'm not justifying, they're doing, but certainly there's like, and we had various shows in mental health where sometimes we criminalize everybody that does bad, right? And I mean, yes, some people deserve to be, labeled as such, but if we go deep dive, they all have a story that drove them to whatever they are. Some go to addiction, some become completely, off, and they can do bad things in this world. And yes, we have seen them historically, in world stages, and we've seen them in personal levels. But it's difficult. So thank you for just, at least giving us that little, view, or at least overview, I would say, on the link between, a big, thing that happens to people, that they don't even get to speak about. And again, what I don't get is the concept is that people don't talk about it because it's been almost a shameful thing. Yet it is not. I mean, people don't volunteer themselves to these events. Maybe they put themselves in, and I'm not, again, justifying. Sometimes you could be in the wrong environment, you're not knowing it, and it can happen. And yet now you're being abused, or you're being subjected to this type of abuse. And it could be, as you said, verbal, physical, many things, and by the way, it can happen in, it's sadly said, it can happen in the
Anywhere.
most, exactly, anywhere, and in the most conservative ways too. Like, I mean, not, I don't want to go into the religious aspect, but we've heard in church, for example, and in other types of denomination and so on and so forth. So you can't tell this person is like, they're above the law when it comes to this. They're above this. Everybody can fall into this trap, and sometimes, we have these circumstances that do affect. And I think here I want to, just link this to the idea of parents' role in this and how they can potentially maybe even prevent, and what can we do to maybe be ahead of the game, and whether it's in terms of education or, some sort of parenting skills that we can guide, our kids, early on to be aware of these behaviors, and maybe like, hey, there's no shame in the game. Tell me if there's something happened. Because I think there's, because we shelter, our kids to a degree, we don't want them to say anything, they might not even say it, right? So maybe we can talk about that. But I love also what you said about what you do in your treatment. It's not so much, hey, you have a drug or alcohol or some type of addiction, let's just, get the addiction out. But the addiction is the symptom. It's like, what, you the almost the outcome of the source. And so you go back to the deep source. And if you can find out what that is, so you basically deep dive into the brain of the person, the actual mental state, and what drove the person to even start. And actually, everyone that has an addiction, and I'm not an expert, but having this for 5 years, this type of shows, I've had enough discussions to know that there is not even one person that would deny that it's not the addiction that started, the problems. Something started, the problems in their life. Therefore, they went into some sort of addiction to prevent, or at least to suppress and numb everything there. Because addiction can be cool. It gives you all the hype and then the high, and you can just kind of like close everything out and you're good. Life is peachy temporarily, but then the aftermath of it is devastating to your health, and it has so many crazy outcomes that can be, including again suicidal ideation, and people do take lives, and that's the thing. It's a sad, statement that we live in a society where we have all this stuff that is very common now. More, and again, maybe it's me. Is it more common today? Was it, even existing before? There's nobody talked about it. And that's the other thing. Maybe you can enlighten that, because I mean, I'm sure you have some insights as to whether this is a new thing or an older thing, because you said,
You mean the addiction or
well, the addiction has always been out there, but I'm talking about like, the I guess the sexual abuse and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure that this is
Yeah,
not a new
it's
phenomenon.
it was and it was because it wasn't always seen as trauma. it was, I mean, really early on, built into culture. Back to the Roman times, it was a sign of wealth and status, to take a child on for a lover. What we're talking about is, not culturally sanctioned, not a rite of passage, not to highlight or to communicate somebody's value or worth in society and their status. That was thousands of years ago. And I'm like you, I don't know if it's worse. I know that we are talking about it more, which is great. But I don't, my gut is it's not any worse today than it was 10 years ago.
So that's a great way to look at it. I mean, and see again, for someone may think, well, now that we talk about it, maybe it's, better, or maybe, we could
Right.
say
It's
that
worse
just so.
because we're talking about it. I don't see the causality. It's not a math equation that way. If A, then B. I don't think that's how this stuff works.
I personally think the more we talk about it is a better thing, because the more we can
For
resolve
sure.
things, people are aware and they have access now
Yeah, I think
to
that's where the
speak.
solution lies, is that the more comfortable we as a communities can talk about it, the easier it will be for children not to keep it a secret, for interventions to come far earlier before all of these maladaptive coping mechanisms take root in that child or adult's life who's been abused. And then you made a really great point. Using drugs, most of us, we didn't start out thinking, I want to be a drug addict when I grow up. And we chase after, we've heard the expression chasing the high or chasing the dragon. And most drug addicts that I know and treat and myself, we would have liked to have stopped years before we did. But fear drives most of it. Because withdrawals, as drugs get better in terms of the interaction with the brain, like fentanyl, for example, as they get better, they get a lot harder to get off. And our neurologically, our brain screams at the person. If like you, I mean, if you
Deprived.
think about it, people do things that are unconscionable to get the resources to be able to get more drugs. In their right mind, they wouldn't think of doing these things. But we get hijacked, our brain takes over. And I have tremendous compassion. I also know that as a group of people, we are a giant pain in the ass for lots of other people that don't struggle with this.
Well, again, but as I said, I mean, we, when you say we as a group, I mean, I think you, the group of folks that may, have experienced addiction, or anybody else, I think we're on the same boat in a way, because the drugs are available in our society. It's not like it's only one group of people that have access to them. Anybody can be exposed to them at a given point. And that's the other thing, awareness, and what they are and what they look like and what they could be. And
Well,
as you, yeah.
the hard part is, I can't tell you how many people have said things like, "Well, I know plenty of people who were abused and didn't become a drug addict. How do you explain that?" And I don't really explain it. The only thing I've been able to come up with is it's a matter of resilience, and that resiliency is not something generally that we can teach or give to somebody. You have it and nurture it, or you don't have it. That's just my thought on the matter. But it is a an un, it's not a tangible thing. We hear remarkable stories of people all the time. They make movies out of it in Hollywood about these remarkable people that have overcome insurmountable odds. And yet there are millions and millions of people that didn't overcome it. I think that's resilience.
Well, but I love that. And again, resilience, as you said, it's unique. Everybody's got, some people have more than others, and we experience it during hardship and tough times. But again, not everybody is as strong as maybe some people are stronger than others in circumstance. But the thing is that, yes, there is, they may not have gone into addiction, but we don't know what the coping mechanism that they have. I mean, some people go into different ways to
Sure.
kind of subdue whatever that is. I mean, they can go, for example, someone who's been abused, they go to law enforcement to make a difference and kind of go after the people that did bad things, right? I mean, that's just an example. Some people can go to martial arts and become these guys that can go fight in the UFC and get all their stuff. I'm not judging, but I'm just saying, like,
No,
there's
yeah,
many
you're
ways
right.
that someone can deal with things. And but then if they're exposed to the way of drugs, which is soothing in the beginning, because it numbs everything, you're cool, it gives you the high. But then, as you said, once that's hijacked and the system is hooked, that's where it becomes a tragedy, because you can't really get out of these things that easy. I mean, unless you go to a program, and even the
Right.
programs can be long and lengthy, and there's a lot of work, and there's so much stuff that is affected.
Yeah,
But
they're expensive. Yeah, not everybody has health care. I will say that what created this perfect storm, I think, for me is regardless of well, maybe not regardless of the trauma, but I've had childhood migraines, and I was given Emprin codeine from the time I was about 4 or 5. And so my brain was already introduced to codeine and opiate-like effects. And I don't remember the day or time, but I do remember that there was a shift when I started to take the pills when I didn't have a physiological need for it. Because I remember, besides the physical pain, it numbed the emotional as well. So I just left because my migraines got better over time. But I was left with this opiate addiction.
you already tasted
And
it, and yeah, I mean, it's like having a nice sweet, I guess sugary stuff, and how that feeling is, and you just,
yeah.
the minute you see it, you get, hey, I need a sweet tooth, like, I want to get some
Psycho
stuff. Yeah.
psychologically speaking, addiction does something that doesn't get talked about a lot. It provides a predictable outcome. And that's one thing that, especially for trauma survivors, that we don't have are predictable outcomes. That relying on people in a trauma survivor's life, that wasn't a good idea. And so, especially as kids, we tend to black and white things. So, one bad, all bad. So, I think that's where kind of my loneliness kind of started is I guess I'm gonna have to figure this out by myself. And I didn't want to be dependent on people because that was a crapshoot. Because the person that did this wouldn't be it's not a stranger. And then actually only they say 10% of childhood trauma is from a stranger, which is even scarier. That
Yeah.
90% of our children are being harmed by people they know.
Trust factor, that's what it is. You trust people.
Yeah. And, it's really hard. It's hard to know. It would be, I'm going to say, trust me, I have thought about a way to create a manual on how to bubble wrap your child from being harmed. And I don't have that manual because there's too many variables involved. I think parents should trust their gut and be willing to. I know we're jumping here, but it's on my mind.
We're good. Love it.
Oftentimes we do not make a decision because of how our decision or what we want to say might be taken by the other person. We don't want to hurt people's feelings. Viewed in the context of you want to hurt somebody's feelings or ensure that your child is safe, I think that's more of a no-brainer. But most parents, they don't think about it that way.
Well,
But
we
in
see that.
hindsight, I think that it is that simple. If only I had known, is a very sad place to be in as a parent.
Well, Andrew, I think that's a fact for children abuse cases, but also for abuse in general. Because I mean,
Sure.
you got spousal, marital stuff where you have somebody that is abusive, and usually because they don't want to address it, or because they are afraid that the outcome is going to hurt the other person, they keep, the
Yeah.
abuse to themselves, and they keep, getting abused over time. And
Or
it's
what
like,
are the neighbors going to think? Or what about
exactly.
our friends? So all of that chatter in the background, unfortunately, there's a consequence to prioritizing anything over. As a parent, our gut as a parent, I think, is really reliable, and I don't know that we rely on it enough.
So on that note, what, there, I'm sure for audiences, they're either parents, or they have parents in their midst, or they have, they own, they basically have their own parents. So we are connected to somebody with a parent status, right? So at the end of the day, I think, what can we tell people? Because as you said, you can't find a bubble wrap formula like that is like solid. But there are signs of, that we should be aware of, and look for, and definitely the advice potentially is to be open with your children at all times on, especially this topic, this, and like, a stranger danger, that kind of concept, this is exactly that, but it's just a higher level of awareness on it, because now it's like, hey, everybody can be. And by the way, as you're right, you listen, there's no doubt here. I have a case personally that I know of in my own environment, where someone that's being abused by someone that's very close family member. And so I can tell you that this is a real thing, folks. It happens when you least expect it, from the least people you might, see potentially. I don't know why it happens. I think people, again, people need help, at all ages, and including those people that do take these actions. I mean, there's
Yeah,
plenty of
that's
available.
important. That's what you're saying is important. It doesn't get this topic doesn't usually go in the direction of the people who do the abusing, but I wholeheartedly agree with you that that person is in pain as well, and ruining people's lives. And so everybody's a different angle or attachment to this issue.
Well, again, I would not accept anyone taking any of those, stuff, but I get it. Like, again, there is a reason someone does something, and there's always a factor, and again, they might have experienced it themselves, and it's just like, it's cool for me, I can do it again, and now it's my turn. There could be a lot of things, and the mind is very weird in how it operates, right? And so again, it's all copings, and people use different ways to deal with what they have to deal with. But again, the key here is for our parents, if you don't mind, and any little signs that we should look for in terms of our kids, maybe things that triggers that can show you, like, maybe my child is not really 100%. There's something there to read. Because I think that's, and I have another pet peeve today, is that with today's, I guess, way raising our kids is different. And you and I, we were raised in the same probably decade. We're only 2 years apart, so I can relate to the decade that we went in. We did not actually stay in our rooms, and gaming and stuff like that. We were live and kicking outdoors and stuff. And so it's a little bit more different. But today, it's even hard to even talk to your kids, because they're very, like, in their own, bubble, literally. I mean, they're in their rooms for the most part. And there's the social media concept now. There are people that are being abused in a different way, and bullied, in the system. And this also touches on bullying and all that. But it's all, there's just different ways things are happening now. But in your expertise, how can parents kind of, like, there's got to be triggers or different flags that we should be looking for, as individuals, whether children or adults, and also parents that have kids that want to protect their kids. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that there are, generally speaking, there are eight different categories of signs, let's call them. There's physical signs, unexplained injuries or bruises or welts, frequent injuries or patterns of injuries to specific parts of the body, signs of malnutrition or neglect. The second area would be behavioral changes. If your kid has really sudden, my kid's not themselves, that's something important to pay attention to. For example, if they become more withdrawn or overly anxious, if things start to feel out of character, extreme changes in mood or personality, So a child who doesn't get angry and or violent, who then seemingly out of the blue becomes angry and violent. When it comes to sexual abuse, the isolation, not wanting people to be around, not wanting to be hugged or kissed goodnight, new kind of symptoms that kind of wasn't true yesterday. Number three is regression. And that is when we revert to earlier childhood behaviors, specifically bedwetting and thumb sucking, or the use of a transitional object that one that are that a child might have used when they were younger. And that's just the nonverbal cue that something on the outside taken to make the inside feel safer is one of those kind of transitional objects. Number four is fearfulness. Number five would be a change in kind of social situations, struggling to make friends, interacting with peers, again, when that wasn't an issue before. And new social and public avoidance. Number six, academic issues. So kind of changes or declines in grades, suddenly no longer interested in school. Doesn't for the child who performs well academically, and you know that they just love to be praised for that. If they are still doing well, but they don't want to be praised anymore, that would be a red flag for me as a clinician and as a parent. That just screams shame or a lack of deservingness to me. So that's academic issues. Then inappropriate sexual behavior. So depending on the age, inappropriate knowledge for the developmental age, words used to describe body parts that your child, as far as you know, has never used that word to describe that part. And then the biggest one would be a disclosure. It's to feel like a truck hit you, but that's the ideal situation is for a child to tell their parent, this is what's happening to me, and I don't know what to do, or I don't know how to talk about it, but I don't want to go to that person's house, or I don't want that person to come to our house anymore. We have to pay attention to that stuff.
Well, thank you, and thank you for really giving us all the. I mean, these are big
Yeah,
highlights, and
those are all of them.
I mean,
I've
what
looked
they.
into it.
No. Well, thank you because for our audiences, just first of all, you said something even earlier about trusting your gut, and so you do get the feeling when something is
Yeah.
off, but now you have all these list of things that you can check. Maybe one of these things is really making a scene here. Like,
Yeah.
we can deep dive, and you're right. I mean, maybe we can address it. And so I think that's the thing. If the parents are open to have that conversation with their children, I think this could be a great place to start. I mean, if you see something off, ask about it, and maybe again, maybe they'll open up. I love what you said when you started the show that you got tricked into going to the therapist. That's another way. If you couldn't do it directly, maybe there's a way to do that and kind of have them exposed to someone who's an expert, such as yourself, to get that out of them. And you know how to do this stuff. You know how to break that discussion without any offensive or feelings for these folks, and so therefore they'll be comfortable to open up to you. And so that's the thing. So there's different ways that I think but love the at least when we know what we're looking for, it's a lot easier. So thank you for
And
sharing all those.
maybe I could get you like a list, and you can provide it as a resource to your listeners and viewers.
Well, that would be awesome. And again,
Sure.
we have you. We're gonna have your site here,
Yeah.
so people can definitely check in as well with you. But you're right. Like, some people may not be available in your territory, and so this could
Yeah.
be accessible to people. But these are things that can be literally life savings for a lot of people, because the minute you start seeing that. But here's a challenge though, and Andrew, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but we're living in a society today that is very busy. And parents, sometimes they work double jobs, especially the economies that we're in today is a little tough. People may not even see their children, right? And so they come in tired from work, they don't have time, the weekend they're running. they may not even have time to spend with their children. So they might miss days and weeks, sometimes even months. And this stuff can be already like, adding up in the children's, mind. And so therefore they're starting to maybe do things that are not appropriate, or thinking about bad things, bad outcomes. So that's the other problem. I think today we need to be so close to our, in children, and spend the time and make the time, I would say, to at least, be connected with your kids in a way that is more direct than just via text, or maybe just say hi and bye and stuff like that. And it is very difficult, folks. I
Yeah.
know, because, especially as they get older, the odds of you
They're
controlling
not going to want to
and
talk to you.
exactly. So it becomes, again, you're the expert. You know this better. But I'm just talking as a parent. It is just in general very difficult. So now when they have other things, they, as you said, they're not gonna open, they may open up to a stranger.
Right. And I'm even speaking about myself as a parent. Like, there's a window where our kids want to seek us out. And my goal with my wife was, where, if possible, because the first three quarters of my career is with adolescents, wherever possible, we need to do whatever we need to do to keep that window open to where our daughters want to speak to us, because we get one shot at this. Somewhere between 15 and 18 years, for lots of parents. And I would say the best thing, you can't start too early, to have a meal together. I think that's becoming a lost family traditional value. I think mom and dad identifying what family values are in that family, and having conversations with your kids about, instead of "this is a rule" or "you can or can't do this," it's easier for kids to hear one of the values that we have in this family. That's a different statement than "you can't do this." And yet we could say the same thing after it. It's just one's a value, and it speaks to the whole family, not just to the kid's behavior. That makes things easier. So that would be my recommendation. Start early. We all know that changing the rules on an adolescent doesn't generally go too well. If they're 16 and it was okay on Monday, if when the parent gets freaked out and they want to change the rules on Tuesday, don't expect a positive reaction to that. I think the parent still needs to do it, and as parents, we need to be able to sit and tolerate our children's distress, because we're not supposed to be their friends. So, well, I don't want to upset my child. That's not the healthiest position to come from. It's
Also,
okay if
there.
my children get upset, because they're going to learn that in life we get upset. But more importantly, they're going to learn that we feel better, and that it's not the end of the world if we protect them and wrap bubble paper around them during childhood. They don't learn how to experience upset, and it's a vital skill.
That's what I was gonna interject, is that we live now where you almost like you can't speak to your children in a particular way now, like back in the days, so the kids are almost, they can throw a tantrum early on, and you just gotta accept it and let them be, and let them be kids and stuff. So as you said, like you're not supposed to be their friend, but now there's a lot of discussion, like, well, you're supposed to be close to them, you gotta become their best friend, and so on and so forth. I think that takes away from you being a parent and being the protector, and so on and so forth. So again, I don't know if that's even, because that's probably a debatable discussion. Someone says, look, I can be still their friend and be their parent and still get the best out of them. I don't know if that works or not. I mean, I have not seen that work, at least not for me. But I know it is a difficult balance. But I think in today's, I mean, I see kids today that have behaviors that, if you look at them, they're not going to listen to their parents. They don't listen at early on. So imagine when they get a little older, how does that going to work, right? You never were able to tell them not to do things when they were, in the early days. Now they're
Yeah.
teenagers. How are you going to stop them from doing certain things and tell them, hey, you can't do this, you can't do that. Like, who are you to tell me this? You know? And so
Yeah,
that's
it
a
just gets
problem that
harder.
get harder, yeah.
Yeah. It's getting dark where I am, so I don't
No,
know
you're good.
if
No,
this
you're
light
good.
makes it okay. Okay.
No, I can see you.
Okay.
You're all right. Well, so thank you. I mean, we've covered this. This is a big topic on its own, and you know, we can spend hours. But you do more than just, you know, I guess children and abuse. I mean, you do all kind of stuff. So
Yeah, like
now let's
right
talk.
now, our treatment center is only adults. And so we get the byproduct of somebody who hasn't spoken about some, you know, call it a big ugly. They haven't spoken about that big ugly. And the role the drugs played is to keep the big ugly away. Except now the very thing that was included in a person's life to protect them from emotional distress is now the cause of all their problems. Which for some people, that's part of the lure to it, is it becomes a distraction from all the stuff that's underneath it. And if I'm worried about, which most of us addicts and alcoholics are, the getting and the using is a full-time job. Where am I going to get it? Do I have the finances to get it? What if I run out? Is my phone charged? Because that's where the number of the person that I get what I need is kept. So it just becomes insurmountable, the anxiety of being able to keep the wheel spinning.
Well, Andrew, so there is a big note about that, and the problem now again, it's an economy of its own. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff, and you're right. You can get introduced to them medically speaking, but you can also get introduced to them. I mean, literally as early as middle school, and you know, pretty much everywhere in the nation we have drug programs in schools, right? But somehow, I have this discussion with my kids all the time because my kids tell me stories that are like unbelievable in their school system, right? I mean. Kids are dealing, and you know, I mean, there's stuff that's happening every day in the school, and it's like it's a known fact. Yet there's nothing being done about it. It's not like you're arresting these kids, right? And you know, but the sales are there, so people are getting you know little gummies and little things and
Yep.
edibles and so on and so forth. You know, early on, and they get in a nice stuff. There's parties going on, and there's all kind of stuff that gets exchanged in those parties. And the next thing you know, these kids are now having to be really addicted that early on. I mean, I'm talking to 8 kids, but you're right. It's not just the kids that have this problem. I mean, obviously, adults can things events can happen in life, tragedies, change of stuff, marital, you know, dispute, whatever. Something can be triggering someone to have a breakdown, and you know, and the next thing you know, that's the first source they go. But I love what you said, you know, because what you just enumerated there is something that we don't think about it. Like the concept of just thinking about a phone. That because that's a means of communication, that's where the number is. I wouldn't have thought about that. But you know that for a fact because that's what people actually are looking. When you're in that position, that's what you need. Those are the tools. And you're right, you know, if you don't have the means, now what happens? Now you're gonna go steal and you can do bad things just to get your fix,
For
right?
sure.
So again, we're not judging folks, but this is the real stuff. This is the real problem. Like you get into this loop or like I don't know, like it's
Yeah.
just a whirlpool that drags you down into
It's a drain.
it's a drain, exactly. You're sucked in and it's like you're in a vortex and there's no way out. And it's just like, you know, it's unless you seek the help. That's the other thing. Admitting that you have a problem, that's always big. That's a big problem. And again, I've heard this over and over in the discussions. It's not easy for someone to see that I need the help and then seek the help. You know,
Right,
and
we need denial, because the denial is what fuels the addiction. If we don't discount what people are telling us around us and seeing and accusing us of, if we don't keep discounting it, it chips through the denial, which is what's keeping the addiction alive. That's why interventions are so successful, because everybody who cares about that person comes together. And it gets usually, well, in a successful intervention, it's too hard to avoid it. And they take a leap of faith that they won't die. That's what we're afraid of. And I don't know if people know that, but the reason we don't stop is because we're afraid we're going to die if we do. And it's not an exaggeration. Like, I will die. And the reason we think that is just going 15 minutes past when our brain tells us we need more opiates. It's a type of discomfort that people don't know. It's horrendous. And we have the solution in our brain. It just, we have to
Thanks.
go find it. Yeah, I just need more. We all hear it in movies, like, I need to get well. I have clients that will call our admission line and say, I'm not ready. I need to get well first, like before they get on an airplane to come to us. I mean, we get it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, it does to them. I mean, because again, as you
Yes, of
said,
course.
for them, it's the end of the world. I mean, that. Listen, everybody that's experienced any type of pain, right? It is nobody wants pain. I mean,
Well,
the reason.
that's the best point of everything is all of our stories are different. Some are sadder than others, but the one thing that binds all of us together who struggle with addiction is pain. We all know what pain feels like. The story is secondary, but pain is a unifier. And that's where we connect with our clients from that place of, there's an old saying, for those who understand, an explanation isn't necessary. And for those who don't understand, an explanation isn't possible. And our clients know that we understand. And so we cut a lot of the nonsense out, which is trying to convince somebody that my problem has value, that it, I wrote my thesis to get out of grad school on bridging, making a connection between how we think of grief and loss and its relationship to the surrender of a dependent relationship with drugs and alcohol. That when a person who's been addicted to something for a long time stops using for whatever reason, that's potentiates a grief reaction and it requires grief work because that drug of choice has done something that people couldn't do.
Well, Andrew, so you mentioned something about like how people are they want the healing, right? And yet they don't want, the feeling that they're gonna die, right? But the problem, I mean, it's not a problem, it's a fact. Opioids today are killing people,
More than ever.
more exactly. So it is a real killer. I mean, people are dying from overdose left to right, from use, right? And so that's like how, I mean, luckily we have you and the programs and you're going out there, you're talking to big guys and even national television to bring some of this information out there because it is an important piece. But the thing is, this is the real thing, folks. If we are not taking the treatment or facing the reality of what we are, opioid is a real problem and it is existing and it's not going anywhere anytime soon. I mean, yes, there's programs, there's discussions, but there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of stuff that is going on because this is also an industry. So there's all that. And there's also the illegal stuff that's out there in the market. I mean, we're talking there's a whole industry that is real, and there's an industry that is backed up
And
that is literally.
that's the to make things even worse than they already are, is now fentanyl, for example, is finding its way into other substances. And most of us get our illicit substances from the street. So if somebody more and more, for example, I just heard about one of my best friend's friend died. And everybody thought it was from a cocaine overdose. It wasn't. It was because he got cocaine that had fentanyl in it. And he had doesn't use opiates. And it's a respiratory suppressant. And he died. And it's showing up more and more in other substances. So it is Russian roulette more than ever before.
Is that because, it is chemically easier to make outside of, an
Yeah,
actual drug pharmacy concept? I mean, because
it
that,
is.
they have all these labs, right? Yeah, so it's
It's cheaper, and then another This is more anecdotal than science. A drug dealer will make more money long term with an opiate dependent customer than a cocaine dependent customer. It's a lot more affordable, but the addiction tends to last 10 to 15 times longer. And so it's the economy of scale. It's you, they are building their manufacturing opiate addicts.
Area. I mean, just thinking about it. I mean, unfortunately, there aren't, I guess depends where you are. I mean, the laws are also not particularly, very protective to this. And, maybe there's more that we can do on the legislative stuff, to not only ban but also
Well, both
prosecute
sides
and
haven't
create.
worked. We look at Seattle, they've decriminalized substances, and there's just as many people living on the street and seeking treatment as when it was criminalized. And you have a state like California that heavily penalizes drug use, and Utah, just to name two. So there's not a lot of difference, regardless of how it's
Legislate.
legislatively managed.
But really, that's not going to do it any good. Well,
Because
here I'm a,
we don't care. There's a maybe this idea that a drug addict is going to prioritize the fear of getting in trouble more than their brain saying, I'm going to kill you if you don't give me more. And the law's never going to be prioritized over that, ever.
you deal with the current situation, which is that
Right,
moment, and
because
that, yeah.
that's logical. And drug addiction is rooted in not in logic.
Listen, I mean, it is a tough, place to be. And again, hopefully, the work you do is making a difference. Now,
It
I mean,
does, and people do get better. And I've had bad things happen, and I'm thriving. Like people make it through and recover, and nothing bad happens. And talk about painful experiences. And it's not as hard as people think. It's just really not.
Let's talk about that, Andrew, because again, a lot of people are afraid to transit into a treatment program. Now, let's put the cost of it to the side, because that's a different animal on its own. But the idea is that I'm here, as you said, I got pain, I get the fix, I get the healing, right? But going to a program means I got to get rid of this fix and get some sort of a substitute fix. I mean, methadone, for example, is a formula that, I mean, I had this question before, which, Dr. Heim, who's our, psychiatrist that, we have a show with monthly, he said that, he's a pro methadone because that actually works as a formula to address some of the stuff. Now,
Yeah.
again, the pain that, I've had from someone that I interviewed was intense with methadone more than the opioid, or at least that's how he saw it to be, right? Now, and that's where I asked the question, like, was this,
Yeah.
something that is, effect? It does, it's difficult at this transition, but it is necessary to get you out of that stuff in your system. And so that's the part that is very difficult to because when people hear this, like, and it is very common to hear that in the street, like, hey, listen, you go to this program, it's gonna go, it's brutal, blah, blah, blah. And some people are like, I'm not gonna do this. I'd rather get my fix and I'm good. It gets worse when you can't afford it, but as long as you can afford whatever is in the street, you'll be cool,
Yeah.
right? But the minute things get a little rough and your finances are not happening, and again, today's economy is probably not the best. So a lot of people could probably be seeking the worst potential substitutes out there to
Yeah.
just get the fix. So that can be a challenge. But so when you deal with someone that comes to you, I mean, how is that transition, I guess,
Well, there's two ways
facilitated
to,
or eased up?
well, speaking about opioid addiction in particular. We don't use methadone. It's kind of an older drug. We use buprenorphine, commonly known as Subutex or Suboxone, and there's two ways to take that as part of a quick detox protocol. Go from 16 milligrams to 12, to 10, to 8, to 6, to 4, to 2. Or you go on Suboxone maintenance, which is People can live the rest of their lives on it. It does a good enough job of blocking the opiate receptor sites in the brain, so the brain isn't looking for any fix. It's satisfied. I think if I understood what you're saying about the person you spoke to about the methadone, if you stay on it too long, you're going to get addicted to the replacement substance. And that's where a short-term, under a doctor's care titration program is ideal. In order for that to work, the person has to be able to tolerate a week or two, and sometimes longer. Honestly, they're going to be uncomfortable. They're going to have diarrhea. They're going to vomit. Emotionally, they're going to be a wreck, be angry, depressed, as the body is working that poison out. It goes kicking and screaming.
Well, this is just, I mean, you're giving us some of the, I guess, the symptoms of the drug, the substitution, like, the things that the medicine that you're actually taking to really get you fixed. I mean, certainly the body's going to have to be on overgear here, like, just running triple shift to get things, done. And, again, well, so that's the thing. I mean, the fear of getting through that process may be like, you know what, I have pain, but this sounds a lot more pain. Why would I go into it, right? But then if you look at the long term, that this is going to, yes, 10, 10 days, 2 weeks, but then you'll be much better and then you don't have to worry about it. So it's, yeah, it's a small price to pay for, a better outcome, long term outcome. But again, for someone, if they're out there and they need the help, we just need to hopefully get them to understand that this is going to be best for them as a solution, and it's probably going to work. And I love what you said. You have different, ways of doing the administration of these things, and that's only for opiate, but there's other types of drugs. Like, I know you do heroin and cocaine and all these things, and each one of them has a different way to, I guess, how it works. I'm not sure if you do alcohol or.
I mean, alcohol is probably the biggest. And
Really?
yes, and I mean, technically, I think detox came about because there are two primary substances that a person can die from the withdrawal process, and that's alcohol and benzodiazepines. Benzos are the Ativan, Xanax, the sedative, hypnotic, anxiolytic class of medication, the anti-anxiety medication. When those are misused, people can have a seizure and die from that and alcohol withdrawal. And so that we see alcohol, benzos, and opiates the most. And for alcohol, the doctor usually gives like an anti seizure medicine because of that potential for a seizure and death. And they also give Ativan or Valium are the kind of common old school way would be to give phenobarbital, a barbiturate, and it takes the edge off enough to where the person's not going to die. And it helps manage the shakes. So
Scary.
look, it's uncomfortable, no doubt about it. You've relied on something and not experienced pain for however long. To be in the world where we experience pain sometimes, our brain needs some time to adjust to that. But it's not forever. We do get better. And the evidence of that are the tens of millions of people that are walking around sober that go to anonymous meetings every day, because relationships are the antidote to all this.
Well, so that was my next question, is that there's protocols that have the medicational stuff, the medication process administration, but there's also the therapy part and the behavioral part. So let's
Which
talk
is a
about
much
those
bigger
other.
part. It's a much bigger part than the medicine part. The medicine part takes under 4 minutes a day, as long as it takes to go sit in the nurse's chair. But the therapy is 6 hours, about 6 hours a day. And that's a combination of group therapy, sessions with a psychiatrist, a primary care physician, a licensed clinician. We have All our staff are recovery specialists and treatment mentors. Majority of them have been through recovery. The most comforting words in the world are "me too." When that person who's new in recovery sits with somebody else and is able to talk about an experience they thought maybe they were the only one, and for the person, at least in this case, on staff, to say, "Me too, man. I've been there." And the sharing of those experiences normalizes it a bit, takes the shame away. And we just do a lot of that for about 25 to 30 days.
That's what the programs are about, 30 days. Okay, so but it is it like where someone is in the facility or they could be like
We have a,
outpatient?
it's residential. After the detox, the next level of care is residential. Majority of our clients leave before 30 days. And then ideally, we step them down to the next lower level of care, which is it's called PHP, which stands for partial hospitalization. And that's just like residential, but you don't sleep there. So you either live at home and you come for the day to get your medicine, psychiatry, counseling, family therapy, and then IOP, intensive outpatient. That's 3 days a week, 3 hours a day. And so, kind of from here to here to here, and then there's nothing greater than to watch somebody go live their life in practice. And then, if you believe in the 12 steps, which I do, but the way I say it usually is I'm brand loyal, but I'm not stubborn. So it doesn't matter if you don't like 12 steps. So don't like 12 steps. I think if you want what people, like me who are sober and other people who are sober, if you want what we have, there's lots of ways to get it.
Thank you. I mean, I think I want to just commend you and thank you for the work you do because
Sure.
you do help people. And I know you had your own story and it helped you get into this world and have a mission to, and I'm sure the whole transition, the study and all stuff is, was there's particular stuff that goes in there and, and there's family values in there. But you mentioned something about the family therapy that comes with that. So you do add, value with
Oh,
bringing
yeah.
family member, because I think that's
The
one thing I started.
outcomes, the outcomes to treatment and a person's ability to remain sober long term is directly related to the social support and network around that person. And so, in detox and residential is a great time to bring the family back together now that the substances are not the focus. And everybody gets to, have it out if they need to, or hug it out if they need to. But everybody's been terrified and affected by one family member's disease of addiction and held hostage by it. And it's fucking exhausting for everybody. So we do whatever we can to push a family therapy, couples counseling, and teach people how to talk to each other.
Thank you, Andrew. So now the facility is in Encino, right? So what was the actual Encino detox, right? That's the name.
The Encino Detox. On the website, it's theencinodetoxcenter.com. We have an 800 number, 833-433-2435. Or just Google Andrew Levander. Ha
I'll
happy to
have
be
all that on the
helpful.
description.
Yeah, great.
I'll do all the links. Well, now, just quick, just curiosity. We've kind of briefly talked about suicidal stuff. Do you also do some of that, like therapy when someone is, is
Oh,
suicidal
yeah,
or?
that, yes, because that's often for a lot of people, that's something that they've avoided talking about while they've been addicted. And so, it's actually one of the first requirements when somebody gets to detox is we do a suicide assessment because It's just a horribly difficult time for people, where the thought and belief, I'm not gonna survive this, is very real. And so that's the good stuff that we get to talk about, is that pain that I mentioned before, the shared experience of pain. And when 6 to 12 people are sitting around talking about something in common and they've never talked about it before, they want more of it. It's amazing.
I, you know, anybody that's anyone out there, addiction or no addiction, we know that when you have any issue, the best way to deal with it is to talk about it, right? And usually that the major problem, whether it's at work, at family, you know, is the lack of communication or addressing issues, right? This is a big one. And you're right. If you hold it in your mind's going to play games on you. And you're right. You might start thinking like the world is against you. You know, you're on your own. The pain is too much. Maybe the best way to do this, let me just end this, you know, and, you know, I'll be cool, but that's not the case. Or so I love the concept that that is a priority. And certainly that's the first thing you address and survey for, because you're right. You know, people are going to go through this withdrawal and it's going to be brutal. So if they already have these things, that's a very difficult, you know, place for them to be. So you eliminate that factor upfront, which is excellent. So again, people can
And we
still
have
have
staff
you.
around 24 hours a day. So we exceed this, the kind of the industry standard is to check on your clients every hour. And we exceed that just because I'm a bit neurotic. And so we are doing our rounds every 30 minutes. And that's where we visually see a person's face. We can see their respiration. It gives us a chance every 30 minutes to have a conversation if they want. So.
Well, just curious, because as you say that, I mean, with the technology, with AI, I mean, I think there's more to be done now to monitor the vitals and stuff, you know, very, you know, accurately and
And we've
more frequently.
explored, yeah, we can, I mean, we can, the one thing that I've really explored is a band that a person can wear around their wrist, and it will monitor their vitals. I think that's cool, but it's not better than
Physical.
me or one of my staff members going in one of our clients' room, not waking them up. We use a special flashlight that doesn't wake the brain if you shine it on their face. I want to see that nobody's aspirated, and watch their chest rise 3 times. I mean, that's what they're. I don't like this expression, but that's what they're paying us for. Like, this is, it's a, people die. So
Oh,
I don't
listen,
want
it's the serious stuff, and you're doing beyond, and that's great. So your practice is certainly, you know, top notch, and it has been featured in a lot of, you know, top notch, you know, publications and
Yeah.
media and stuff. So you have a great reputation in your world. So and that's great, you know, to have, because again, and you also, I'm sure other, you know, entities can mimic and do exactly the same thing you do, and it's again with technology. There's always more stuff that you can add. The more you take in, you know, the more you can get better outcomes and you know, hopefully better oversight of these things, and
Yeah.
people are happier. So that's great. Now I know we're on the top of the hour already, but you know,
Yeah.
you and I were briefly talked about those six Fs. You know, if you can just cover them with us today, you know, before we
Sure.
can close this.
Yes. I think there's probably different versions of the six Fs, but they represent areas that promote overall health and wellness, and that's food, fitness, fun, focus, friends, and forgiveness. And the last one is the most important, at least it was for me, and it has nothing to do with anybody else. It was forgive. I needed to forgive myself, that everything that I that happened to me, like so many kids, we end up taking the blame for it, because most people who have harmed don't hear one thing, and that is the person who harmed us, we rarely hear, I'm sorry. And so, in order for kind of, I think, a child to move on, we have to wrap that up somehow. And so, I guess it was my fault, is a way to wrap it up.
That's a mind game on its own. Wow.
Yes,
And
it's
again,
really
yeah,
heavy.
it is. I mean, it's a big burden to carry. I mean, I.
If for sure. That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, it's listen, folks. You know, if you're watching or listening, I mean, this topic is very tough to hear, to even, you know, want to discuss, but it is real, it's serious. And the more we know about it, the more we have, you know, the access to at least, you know, be able to discuss it. I think, again, communication and talking about things is usually a good way to start, and this is a good place to be. It started with you by being able to talk about it with someone. It started with your mom being savvy enough to see that and trick you. But hey, listen, that was a good trick. You know, if
It
those were the
was.
pranks in the world, I mean, we'll take those, right? They're good, you know, for you. But that
For
shows that,
sure.
you know, she loved you and she wanted to take care of business. And yet, you know, here's the thing: the outcome is that you are now helping thousands of people over, again, a quarter century, and that's pretty powerful. I mean, I'm sure you had so many people that really live their life now and even thriving in their lives, you know, doing all stuff. And now, not only that, I mean, you've dealt with some of the top people, from athletes, celebrities, and stuff like that. See, that's, I mean, obviously, that's we can spend another couple of minutes on that one quickly if you don't mind. But that's a world that has so much pressure and stuff, and it's not so much about the abuse, although there might be cases there. But there is a lot of pressure in Hollywood. I mean, you're talking about California, so that's the big hub. It's a lot of celebrities. They deal with a lot of stress and pressure and anxiety and stuff that can cause, you know. There's also a lot of
Remember,
money, and money opens, you know, gates to stuff that is crazy, right? I mean,
yeah, do you remember before when I said that, independent of the story, what we share in common is pain. And so, whether it's a famous person, a wealthy person, or the opposite of that, the pain is the same. And so, it doesn't, we're happy to be helpful to, anybody that needs it. One, I guess, is more exciting for people, but it's all the same stories because really rich and famous people have been abused. So the pain is the same underneath it. And
listen,
it
we're not.
proves the power of it is so, it's so powerful, addiction, I suppose, that regardless of a person's means, from a homeless person to a multi-millionaire famous person, they're both in rehab because none of that other stuff matters. It affects everybody.
Well, thank you. And not only that, I mean, as you said it, even the idea of abuse, I mean, there's different levels of abuse, but you know, you're talking about, we've heard stories about in the celebrity world, right? There's pressures, there's people have to do things that they may not want to do to make
Yeah.
it, you know, so on and so forth.
And
And
that's trauma.
yep. I mean, yeah, you absorb it, you take it, you accept it, you know, because you have a dream, whatever, but people take that dream and take advantage of it, and they put you through hell so you can do it. And by the way, this could be even for like corporate, you know, you want a career path and they put you through hoops and loops
It's
to get you there.
everywhere.
Yeah, so I mean, listen, I get it. And so the fact is, it's all around us, and in today's society is a lot more pressure than anything else. Even today, like, social media is big, right? A lot of people have pressure and anxiety that is delivered through their own phones because they have, you know, bullying, they have pressure from their, I guess, their fan club and all the stuff. And you know, you got the people that are for you, the people that are against you, people that are just jealous, hateful, whatever. I mean, there's the naysayers. I mean, there's all kind of stuff. And people, and it's funny because it's easy now, and there's more of people that are in the limelight, if you want to call it, and they get in all that pressure, and it's not easy. And
It used to end like when we were kids. It used to end at the, I'll see you at the bike rack at 3 o'clock. That's where it used to end, but now it just follows kids home. It follows adults home because nobody gets off their goddamn phone long enough. And in the absence of a healthy identity, if you don't have a healthy identity, your perception of yourself is subject to complete strangers' assessments of you. And that's terrifying to me, that how I feel about myself is dependent on what other feedback other people who don't matter, other feedback that they give me. That's the fear that I have for kids. nowadays.
On that note, Andrew, have you seen a spike in potential cases of folks that need assistance who have been maybe the new generation that has been kind of abused through the social and cyberspace versus the old school? Is there an actual, leap that is driven by social media to your world?
Are you asking,
There's an
where th
increase, for people being abused through social media that are actually now seeking help, which is because it's a new thing, right? It's a new
Yeah.
era.
Well, certainly bullying has increased tenfold in different ways now. And so dealing with the effects of being bullied, I'm not I don't have any specific knowledge on if social media or technology has increased or has impacted like sexual abuse at all. I would say that again, anecdotally, because of all these dating apps and not knowing people that you might be connecting with increases safety issues for people because of such a non-traditional way to meet somebody. And we don't know who anybody is really, just what they type. So yeah, it's all different.
It's a different world we live in,
Yeah.
and again, that takes us to the basics, right? Parents, the element of society, the family. I think we have to get closer to each other and be more, aware,
Yeah,
have more talking.
make time, put the phone down. Yeah. At a minimum.
All right. Well, one more thing before I let you go, because I mean, we could
Okay.
spend
Well,
hours
I'm
here.
in the, yeah, we're gonna have to
Well, the last thing is
close
your
up.
book.
Yeah.
I know you're working on a
Oh, yeah.
book. Yeah. So let's talk about that quickly.
Yeah. I suppose I've been working on it my whole life, in my head, and living it. Right now, the working title is Foraging, the Longing of Lonely Children. And it's, I guess a juxtaposition between how we usually look at the word foraging, and that's looking for food and shelter and sustenance. But for a lonely child, what foraging looks like. And the visual, at least for me growing up, not only with this giant secret, I kind of see myself as a that I was a walking umbilical cord, and I was looking to plug in to get a sense of sustenance and safety met. Had a lot of dependency on other people, which increased my vulnerability. And food issues are very common with survivors of abuse. And so maybe that's a part two is, the relationship that I had with myself as a result of my experiences. It impacted everything. And so yeah, it's a personal story about what a lot of people experience and are not talking about, with the goal of the book at least to be to create a better mechanism for people to talk to each other, like you and I are talking to each other. Not through texting and but really connecting with other people. Because I guess the last thing I'll say is we are drowning in information and technology more than ever right now. And yet I think we're starving for these connections with people. And that
Amazing.
is a first the first time. Even when I say it now, I've been thinking that for a while. It sounds crazy to me. Like, why are we can do anything now. And yet we are struggling more, I think, than ever with just connecting with another person.
Isn't that amazing? We're connected to the world through Google and the internet, and we're disconnected with our own world, the physical
Yeah.
world. It's crazy.
And lonely. Yeah.
Just you think about it, just I mean, it's something that is out of this world, really, and it is real. It's just as real as it gets. Well, so here's the thing. Thank you for sharing about the book,
Yes.
and please do send me when the book is released. You know,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
we'll promote it, and we'll send a
Thank
little
you.
thing about it just to share that it's out. And yeah, because I think that book is going to be valuable to a lot of people to read
Thank
and
you.
really give them a whole different, I guess, spin on things and maybe tools to operate with in the real world. And maybe even if not them, share it with somebody else that might be able to use that information. So thank you.
Yeah,
All
you're
right, well,
welcome.
Andrew, thank you so much for being with us, for sharing
Oh,
your
my
insights,
pleasure.
the work you do, awesome stuff, man. Thank you so much for doing it and helping the masses out there. And even for this, the information you gave today is valuable to a lot of people around the world and in the States, of course, but anybody that
Yeah.
can benefit from this and share the value with others that can help them. So thank you so much for being with us.
My
It's been
pleasure.
real. Thank you. All right, that's it, folks. It's a wrap for today, and hope you enjoyed this discussion. And yes, do check out the link to Andrew's website and facility. You know someone that needs help. There's an opportunity there to take care of business and hopefully be better, live happier. For a good time, and enjoy life for what it's supposed to be. That being said, I'm Hurricane H. We'll be talking soon. Need a new show on the topic. Bye for now.